The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We wish to thank them for their support. We're reading today from the October 2020 edition of Smithsonian. Our reading today is entitled You Don't Know Nero by Joshua Levine. Reassessing history's most maligned ruler, notorious for fiddling while Rome burned. The Colosseum in Rome draws close to 8 million tourists a year, making it one of the world's most visited archaeological attractions. I could see the crowds converging on the magnificent first-century amphitheater as I headed across the street to a small park on a hillock. There was almost no one here, aside from a few young mothers pushing strollers along the pathways. A cluster of nuns passed by, and one of them pointed me toward a poorly marked gate at the base of the hill, the entrance to the Domus Aurea, or what's left of it anyway. I had an appointment to meet Alessandro de Alessio, who oversees the excavation and restoration of what must surely have been, in its day, the world's biggest royal palace. Even before COVID-19, when the site was open to the public on weekends, few people came. The Emperor Nero commandeered many of the neighborhoods raised by the Great Fire of AD 64 to build a palace complex of staggering dimensions. The Domus Aurea, or Golden House as the entire site was known, spread over almost 200 acres, covering the Palatine, Cilician, and Esquiline hills of Rome. It was one of the big reasons that the Roman public suspected Nero of setting the fire himself. No modern scholar and few ancient ones believe he did, but you have to admit, the Domus Aurea seemed to give Nero a fairly good motive for arson. As the first century Roman historian Suetonius describes it, the Domus Aurea was a home fit for a megalomaniac. His wastefulness showed most of all in the architectural projects, Suetonius writes. Parts of the house were overlaid with gold and studded with precious stones and mother of pearl. All the dining rooms had ceilings of fretted ivory, the panels of which could slide back and let a rain of flowers or perfume from hidden sprinklers shower upon his guests. When the palace had been decorated throughout in this lavish style, Nero dedicated it and condescended to remark, "Good. Now I can at last begin to live like a human being." The Domus Aurea is nearly all gone now. The emperors who followed Nero swept it away in a frenzy, attempting to efface him and his works from Roman memory. One section remains, buried beneath the footpaths of the Oppian Hill. The Emperor Trajan built his famous baths right on top of it, filling Nero's vast galleries with soil to support the weight of the baths. Trajan's memory-expunging project succeeded. The crowds who flocked to the Colosseum across the street have no idea that the Domus Aurea is footsteps away. For the past 6 years, De Alessio has been supervising archaeological excavation of the sprawling Domus Aurea's 150-odd rooms. Even before COVID-19, the dig had halted while De Alessio and his crew constructed an alternative drainage system to stabilize conditions inside. Completion of the project lies many years in the future. De Alessio guided me from one high-vaulted gallery to another. Splendid frescoes line some of the walls, in a style we recognize from the ruins at Pompeii, but the distinctive aesthetic later expressed across the Roman Empire originated here at the Domus Aurea. A little farther on, De Alessio led me to a room, its walls surfaced with roughly textured pumice, recreating a natural grotto. The space was dedicated to the nymphs, or female nature deities, whose cult of worship had spread throughout the empire. A micro-mosaic adorns the ceiling. It depicts in astonishing detail a scene from the Odyssey. The ceiling mosaic surely influenced the Byzantines, who later plastered ceiling mosaics almost everywhere. But the Domus Aurea's boldest artistic innovation was surely its architecture. We know little of the two men who designed it, Severus and Cellier. The Alasio thinks Nero himself may have stayed closely involved in this grand-scale project. After all, this is the kind of thing, not ruling Rome, that turned him on. High overhead, an open hole, or oculus, invited the sky in. Rome's Pantheon uses the same device to magnificent effect, but Nero's octagonal room did it first. Alcoves radiated off the main space underneath, inviting the eye to wander to unexpected directions. Precisely angled windows channeled sunlight to hidden niches. Light and shadow danced around the room, following the course of the sun. Pure genius, says De Alessio. The Sala Octagonale is very significant for Roman architecture, but also for the development of Byzantine and Islamic architecture. It is a very important place for Western civilization. Nero left us masterpieces. We have a certain image of Nero from the ancient sources who were against Nero, and also in our time from the movies. The church chose Nero as the representation of evil. But if you see what he made here, you get a completely different idea. Among history's most durable memes, one ranks particularly high. A fleshy fellow in a toga, laurel wreath encircling his temples, standing among the columns of an ancient portico, while all around him fire consumes the great city of Rome. He is not alarmed, quite the contrary. He calmly plucks the strings of a lyre, and yes, even appears to be singing. The meme says everything we need to know about this egotistical monster, his wanton indifference to human suffering, and his pathetic delusions of artistic grandeur. He is at once childish and murderous. The story has been told and retold for almost 2,000 years, but it is Hollywood, not surprisingly, that has supplied the pictures in our heads. Pride of place must surely go to Mervyn LeRoy's 1951 epic Quo Vadis, thanks to Peter Ustinov's deliciously hammy Nero. The actor was nominated for an Oscar. "Look what I have painted," shrieks Ustinov as he watches the technicolor flames engulf his city. Ustinov calls for his lyre. He commences to pluck. "I am one with the gods immortal. I am Nero, the artist who creates with fire," he sings tunelessly. "Burn on, O ancient Rome, burn on." A panicky mob converges on the palace. "They want to survive," explains Nero's level-headed counselor, Petronius, portrayed by Leo Jin, also nominated for an Oscar. "Who asked them to survive?" shrugs Nero. "Great cinema, it isn't. But it is terrific stuff, all the same." And this is more or less the consensus Nero of history, set down first by the Roman historians Tacitus and Suetonius, and etched deeper by the New Testament Book of Revelation and later Christian writings. The man most responsible for Nero's modern incarnation is the Polish novelist Henry Sienkiewicz, whose Quo Vadis, a narrative of the time of Nero, appeared in 1895 and was the basis of the Mervyn LeRoy film and half-dozen other cinematic versions. The plot centers on the doomed love between a young Christian woman and a Roman patrician, but their pallid romance is not what turned the novel into a worldwide sensation. Sienkiewicz researched Roman history deeply. His Nero and other historical characters hum with authenticity. It was they, more than the book's fictional protagonists, who vaulted Quo Vadis to runaway bestseller status, translated into over 50 languages. C.N. Kiewicz ended up winning the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1905. C.N. Kiewicz plucked two strings that resonated loudly with his audience and have done so ever since. Nero's role as the emblematic persecutor of early Christians, parentheses, Poland is a deeply Catholic country, and Nero's political tyranny. To Cynthian Kiewicz, an ardent nationalist, Nero's Rome stood in for Tsarist Russia. But what if Nero wasn't such a monster? What if he didn't invent the specter sport of throwing Christians to the lions in the Colosseum? What if he wasn't the tyrant who murdered upstanding Roman senators and debauched their wives? Indeed, what if the whole lurid rap sheet has been an elaborate setup with Nero as history's patsy? After all, we have no eyewitness testimony from Nero's reign. Any contemporaneous writings have been lost. The ancient Roman sources we do have date from considerably after Nero's suicide in AD 68. The case against Nero, then, is largely hearsay, amplified and distorted over two millennia in history's longest game of telephone. Besides, no one really wants to straighten out the record. Who wants another version of Nero? He's the perfect evil tyrant, just the way he is. A few lonely voices have come to Nero's defense. In 1562, the Milanese polymath Girolamo Cardano published a treatise, Neronis Econominum. He argued that Nero had been slandered by his principal accusers, but Cardano was having his own problems with the Inquisition at the time. Sticking up for a guy who, among other things, supposedly martyred the first Christians for fun was not likely to help his own cause. You put your life at risk if you said something good about Nero, says Angelo Paratico, a historian who translated Cardano's manifesto into English. Paratico's translation, Nero, An Exemplary Life, didn't appear until 2012, by which time historians had started taking another look at the case against Nero. Out of all the modern scholars coming to the emperor's rescue, the most comprehensive is John Drinkwater, an emeritus professor of Roman history at the University of Nottingham. Drinkwater has spent 12 years poring over the charges against Nero and dismantling them one by one. Scourge of Christianity? Nope. Urban pyromaniac? No again. And on down through matricide, wife killing, and a string of other high crimes and misdemeanors. The Nero who appears in Drinkwater's revisionist new account, Nero, Emperor and Court, published last year, is no angel. But one comes away with some sympathy for this needy lightweight who probably never wanted to be emperor in the first place and should have never been allowed to wear the purple toga. Drinkwater is in line with the emerging trend of modern scholarship here, but he goes much further. Nero allowed a ruling clique to administer the Roman Empire, and it did so effectively, argues Drinkwater. Most of what Nero is accused of doing, he probably didn't do, with a few exceptions that fall well within the grisly standards of ancient Roman political machinations. Drinkwater's Nero bears little personal responsibility and not much guilt for much of anything. In the end, says Drinkwater, the men in suits got rid of Nero not for what he did, but for what he failed to act on. On the other hand, Drinkwater believes that Nero probably crooned a few stanzas during the Great Fire, but we'll get to that later. Drinkwater says many modern scholars have been trying to explain why Nero was so awful, that he was a young man put in the wrong job, and therefore he went to the bad. He was tyrannical, not because he was evil, but because he couldn't do the job. That's more or less what I expected, too. I was surprised because my Nero was not coming out like this. My Nero was not the out-and-out evil tyrant, because he was never really in control. Nobody here is tyrannical. The blame for saddling Nero with his unwanted destiny falls squarely on his mother, Agrippina, the younger great-granddaughter of the Emperor Augustus, and a woman of boundless ambition. Nero's father, an odious aristocrat, Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus, died 2 years after Nero was born. Nero became Agrippina's instrument for conquering the man's world of Rome. She moved first to disrupt the planned nuptials of the emperor's daughter, Octavia, so that Nero could marry her. The emperor at the time was Claudius, easily swayed. Agrippina's improbable little lie that Octavia's fiancé had committed incest with his sister proved toxic enough to torpedo the wedding. Readers of Robert Gray's picaresque and hugely popular Claudius novels are unlikely to forget the sexual gymnastics of Messalina, Claudius's notorious wife. In the end, Messalina's antics brought her down, leaving a vacancy in the marriage bed that Agrippina filled in AD 49. Shortly thereafter, Claudius adopted Nero as his own son, making Nero a legitimate claimant to the throne, alongside Claudius's natural son, Britannicus. And finally, in AD 53, Nero married Octavia. The stage was set. Agrippina had managed everything with steely efficiency. The Roman historian Tacitus is not always reliable, and he is certainly not unbiased. But his portrait of Agrippina in her hour of triumph feels right today. From this moment, the country was transformed. Complete obedience was accorded to a woman, not a woman like Messalina, who toyed with national affairs to satisfy her appetites. This was a rigorous, almost masculine despotism. More power to her, says Drinkwater, who is a big fan. I think the Roman Empire lost out by not having Empress Agrippina. Given half the chance, I think she could have been another Catherine the Great. I admire her intelligence, her perspicacity. She was one of the few people who knew how the system worked. For example, Claudius is often reproached for killing a lot of senators, and he did. But when Agrippina comes along, you get very little of that. The modern thinking is that she worked well with the Senate. If she had been given more time, she might have been able to establish a precedent of an active executive woman in Roman politics. Claudius died in AD 54 after eating a mushroom that was either bad or poisoned. Tacitus and the ancients say poisoned on Agrippina's orders, and while there's no hard proof, nobody then or now would put it past her. In either case, Agrippina had greased the succession machine so that Nero, just 17, slid smoothly onto the throne following Claudius's death, past the slightly younger Britannicus. We know very little about the teenager who found himself absolute ruler of a sprawling multi-ethnic empire. He had been educated by the great Stoic philosopher Seneca, but Nero was clearly no Stoic. We do know, however, that the Roman people welcomed their new emperor enthusiastically and held high expectations for his reign. Things started out well, mostly because Nero was no more than happy to allow three highly capable people to steer the ship of state, Seneca, Burrus, and the level-headed commander of the Praetorian Guard, and of course, Agrippina. Behind them stood Drinkwater's men in suits, the senators, well-trained freedmen and ex-slaves who made up a kind of civil service. In Drinkwater's account, the roster of Team Nero shifted around somewhat during the 14 years of his reign, but it oversaw the empire competently. For his part, Nero never gave himself over to the pursuits that mattered most to him, chariot driving, singing, poetry, and playing the cithara, a stringed instrument like a lyre, but more complex and much harder to master. Nero was a thoroughgoing Philhellene, a lover of Greece and its sophisticated culture. he had little of the Roman appetite for blood and conquest, which makes him look far more appealing to us than to the Romans. The Nero meme leaves the impression of an effete dilettante, confident in his own genius only because nobody had the guts to tell him otherwise. This is wrong on several counts. Suetonius tells us that Nero worked very hard to get good at singing. He conscientiously undertook all the usual exercises for strengthening and developing his voice. He would also lie on his back with a slab of lead on his chest, use enemas and emetics to keep down his weight, and refrain from eating apples and every other food considered deleterious to the vocal cords, Suetonius reports, adding cattily that Nero's voice remained feeble and husky. Even the poetry Nero wrote himself was apparently pretty good. The Roman poet Martial tells us so. We have selections of it, and they don't sound anything like the grandiloquent tripe that generally comes out of his mouth in the movies. Nero cannot be dismissed as a mere dabbler. He took his hobby seriously, too seriously, in fact, for a Roman establishment that liked its emperors to make war, not art. Nero was an accomplished athlete as well. Suetonius is impressed that Nero can pilot a 4-camel rig around the racetrack. In other references, we find Nero at the reins of a 10-horse chariot. That was the ancient Roman equivalent of a Formula One car. Nero won races in it. If Nero could do that, he is no fool. He is intelligent. He is fit. On his own terms, he is to be taken seriously and not to be projected as a clown, Drinkwater concludes. Those qualities made the young Nero very popular with the common man. He had an exuberant personality and enjoyed being out in public. He was no snob and remembered the names and faces of people up and down the social ladder. All in all, he comes off as a fairly likable young fellow.
Okay, sure, there were casualties, but let no one be overly troubled by the fact that Nero's brother, Britannicus, turns up dead a year after Nero takes power. He was doomed from the start, Drinkwater writes. Political murder was an accepted tool of governance and made few waves in first-century Rome, provided it was not overused. Everybody did it, just not Nero. You get the impression that people are being murdered all the time, Drinkwater told me, but if you start adding up the Neronian murders, there are not that many of them. Even the thing that people point to later as the real bloodbath, just after the Pisonian conspiracy of AD 65, if you tote up the numbers, they are still quite small, 20 or 30. In terms of 16th or 17th century English politics, that's nothing. It's a surgical strike. I go bananas about this supposed reign of terror. For those involved, it was dreadful, and it's not a society that one would have liked to live in. But it's also not that dangerous for politicians. If you overstepped the mark, you paid the penalty. But most people knew where the boundaries were. Nero's problems with his mother started early on, when he fell in love for real, not with Octavia, his wife, alas. Nero's arranged marriage to her brought neither love nor children. Instead, Nero fell hard for a low-born, free woman named Acte, A-C-T-E. He even flirted with the idea of marrying her, a project Drinkwater calls absolutely silly. But it is Agrippina's disapproval of her son's comportment, not just with his mistress, but a new gang of friends his own age. That plants the wedge between them. He's coming into his own, and his mother is no longer the partner she intended to be. She's an impediment. Before long, Nero strips Agrippina of her personal security detail and kicks her out of the palace. As in much ancient Roman history, the coinage tells the tale. First, Agrippina and Nero stop appearing together on the head side of Roman coins, and she gets flipped to the tail side. Then she disappears from coins altogether. Things go downhill. When Nero falls in love again, this time with his adored future wife, Poppaea, Agrippa tries again to come between them. Are these the real reasons Nero has his mother killed in AD 59? It seems like a stretch, but none of the ancient sources can explain to anyone's satisfaction why Nero commits this atrocity. Even by the grim standards of ancient Rome, you don't kill your mother. Matricide will become a defining moment for the authors of the Nero meme, when he is first fitted for his role as history's monster. The story of the murder verges on the burlesque. Nero invites his mother to a kind of reconciliation party at his country villa in Bay d'On the Bay, Naples. He graciously provides a galley to ferry Agrippina home after the party, but the boat is rigged to come apart at sea. Agrippina is meant to drown, but she is an unexpectedly strong swimmer and manages to make it safely back to shore. After some comical dithering, a henchman is sent to dispatch Agrippina the old-fashioned way, with a sword. When you look at the evidence here, you can play it any way, says Drinkwater. The great joy of doing ancient history is taking the bits you've got and putting them together. Let's be honest, more or less the way you feel. I got to know Nero, and I always felt that he couldn't have done this to his mother in cold blood. They stayed close, even after the breakup over Acte and the squabble over Pompeii. Down to her death, Agrippina is not stripped of her imperial titles, and the actual story of her death is so confused, overdramatic, and elaborated that you could take the whole lot together and suggest that he didn't intend to kill her himself, but that, after the shipwreck or the accident, others seized the opportunity to get rid of her themselves. Here, Drinkwater directs the jury's attention to Seneca, designated by history as the virtuous foil to Nero, the frivolous killer. Seneca's noble suicide, 6 years later, at Nero's not-so-polite invitation, became a favorite theme for European painters. Tacitus puts a parting dig at his executioner in Seneca's mouth. After a mother's and a brother's murder, nothing remains but the destruction of a guardian and tutor. Balderdash, says Drinkwater, Seneca was caught up in the bloody aftermath of Piso's conspiracy, and it's fair to say he knew about the conspiracy beforehand, even if he wasn't a plotter himself. If Seneca lived today, he would have been a TV guru, saying the right thing on his chat program. He had to survive in quite a difficult world so he could write one thing and do another. One thing that recent biographers have made of him is that, when push comes to shove, he lacks moral courage. Good luck to him, but he doesn't come out well at the end. And that wraps up this week's reading called You Don't Know Nero by Joshua Levine. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Hope you've enjoyed it. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.